which is Courtney v. Halloran. Okay, Mr. Krizloff.
Good morning. May it please the court. Judge Bauer, Judge Canning, Judge Wood. The primary issue here is whether in resolving the claims of a failed bank, whether the FDIC exceeded its statutory authority by entering into a settlement agreement which reordered the 1821 D11 statutory payout priorities, enabling shareholders of the bank to receive proceeds of the recovery against the accountants while depositors remained yet unpaid. And the second issue with that is, assuming that the FDIC did exceed its statutory authority, whether the anti-injunction provisions of 1821J precludes the district court from ruling on its legality. We strongly suggest that this is the United States, not Brazil. This is not a place where the wealthy families get to buy a different priority. This court has made it very clear in the bankruptcy context that the statutory priorities are neither precatory nor suggested. They are the law. They may not be violated. And they may not be purchased and sold.
But you've conceded that if the FDIC had settled this case for the lower amount of money, there wouldn't be a problem.
If that settlement would have been at a lower net amount of money, just to take in a lower amount of money.
Right. So the lower amount of money gets poured into the estate. It then gets distributed according to the statutory priorities, and your clients get the same amount that they have gotten.
Right. But if the settlement had been done that way, it would have been done that way. It was not. Once the money was recovered, it became subject to the statutory priorities. It's not a...
Why is that? And why is recovered money the same as money realized for the estate when the Pritzkers themselves, or, you know, the various... I know it's not just the Pritzkers, but the owners probably had their own claims against the accountants.
Maybe
an indemnification claim. I mean, they'd been injured.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The Pritzkers had benefited. They had received $180 million in dividends that were supported only by Ernst & Young's concoction of profits, which the FDIC said were bogus. And in addition, that Dwarman had taken out a loan of $100 million from the bank. I mean, Burt Lance nearly went to prison for
we're
that.
We're not trying Burt Lance here.
No, but by
but
the same token.
It seems to me, though, that the FDI, in its capacity as receiver, was looking to the owners of the bank for very substantial payments, and if they had to make those payments and their accountants hadn't been doing the right job for them, they may have had a claim against the accountants.
They were not damaged by what the accountants did. What the accountants did benefited them. That's the case that they sent over, I believe, Massey and Murphy, shows that there would be no claim for the shareholders, that claim that they would have had to assert would have been a derivative claim. In that respect,
who's the they that we're talking about right now? I'm sorry, I just...
The Murphy case, I believe it's Murphy, Massey, the one that they sent over, defendants sent over last week as their citation of additional authority.
Supplemental authority.
Oh, there it is.
Massey
and Murray against Merrill Lynch. What that suggests is that directors of Merrill Lynch, of Conseco, who were buying stock along with Conseco, they were buying Conseco stock because the Merrill Lynch had opined that the acquisition of GreenTree was fair to Conseco. The individuals sued Merrill Lynch, claiming that they were directly harmed, and this court makes it clear, in Judge Williams' opinion, that claim that they were making was a derivative claim for Conseco, and that the individual directors' claims direct against Merrill Lynch were not well-founded and would not have a direct claim. That would apply equally to any Pritzker CCFC claim against Ernst & Young here. This case really, if analyzed correctly, shows that they had no claim against Ernst & Young. Indeed, they weren't damaged. They were benefited by $300 million. Indeed, if this part of the settlement is found to be invalid, and that's all that we seek, is the rearrangement of that, the reordering of that $30 million payment, that doesn't mean that the settlement agreement itself necessarily gets vacated.
Well, sure it would. I mean, settlements are bilateral engagements, and one side might not be willing to settle. The Pritzkers might not share your view of their ability to recover independently against Ernst & Young, so I think the settlement would be off the table.
Well,
the FDIC
would
have to go back to the drawing board and see if they could persuade E&Y to settle on different terms.
No, they wouldn't. It wouldn't affect the Ernst & Young settlement. It would affect the settlement that CCFC and the Pritzkers made with the FDIC. The Pritzker CCFC entity was subject to about $950 million in potential claims plus interest from the FDIC. And so what they would have to do is they would have to say that in exchange for that, if they have to forego their $30 million from the Ernst & Young settlement, they will blow a $950 million liability back up rather than pay the $100 million down and the $360 that they got to spread over 15 years without interest. They would have to make a very – they certainly would be able to void their agreement with the FDIC, but what they would be looking at is the FDIC coming after them for $950 million. So to trade off 30 for not having that come after them, that would be for them to decide. But that isn't a necessary, it isn't a necessary supposition that the settlement goes out the window. Here, nonetheless, the FDIC still has to follow the priorities of payment. Had it been a net payment of a lesser amount, that would have been a different thing. Once the money comes in as a recovery, which it is, indeed in the...
Well, that is the legal... That's a legal question. I mean, there are a number of legal questions, of course. One legal question is whether recoveries subject to the priority are anything the FDIC holds on to for a little while, or whether they are some lesser amount, such as the 75%. Another issue is how does one reconcile the FDIC's power to settle claims under 1821p3 with the statutory priorities that we don't have in the bankruptcy context. We don't have that settlement authority, and the FDIC has two powers that we need to deal with here. And, of course, the third is the anti-injunction provision.
But the anti-injunction provision, the courts are pretty clear. In fact, the decisions all correctly analyzed show that where the FDIC is acting outside of its authority, then it is both enjoinable and, at the very least, declaratory judgment is appropriate. The only case
But if it isn't acting outside of its authority, if it's just administering this failed bank as it is authorized to do, then you would agree there's no authority to get an injunction.
If
the legal determination goes against you, there's no authority for an injunction.
There's no authority for an injunction if the legal authority goes against me. That's right. But this is not a question of whether or not, in all those cases, it's whether the FDIC should foreclose, should file something, should do something in connection with its absolute with its powers. This is a case where the FDIC has agreed to take in money and pay it out differently from what the statute provides.
Or put differently, it's taking in some money that it thinks belongs to the estate and some money that you don't think they're good claims, but some money that represents somebody else's claims.
Well, no, what they have gotten is a recovery from Ernst & Young. What they have agreed to do is to apportion that recovery between them and the Pritzker CCFC entity. That's a different thing than just saying we're going to take in money that belongs to somebody else. The FDIC...
Well, but because they've recognized that the Pritzkers had some claims, that some of those claims were almost in a sense assigned to them. There was
Well, by the same token, Charles Keating could have made the same argument.
Well, maybe so.
This is not. Had Charles Keating made that argument, he would have been laughed out of court.
We don't know if he didn't make the argument.
Well, the argument is not that you get to buy your way into a higher priority, that you might have some specious claims.
Well, but that's really not giving the FDIC much credit. The FDIC has this very complex situation, and it's trying to get as much money for the estate as it can, and it comes to the decision that having the Pritzkers on their team results in that. Right.
This is not that complex a situation. The FDIC sued Ernst & Young, saying that Ernst & Young was a serial book cooker. That is the FDIC's claim against Ernst & Young. And they weren't cooking the books for the joy of cooking. What they cooked the books for is they created earnings that enabled the Pritzkers and Dworman to take out a $180 million dividend and take out a loan to Dworman, cover up a loan to Dworman, which is extraordinary. I mean, a huge... This $100 million loan from the bank to its 50% owner is an outrageous thing. Burt Lance only took out, I think, $6 million, and he went to prison, or was about to go to prison before he was saved by, I believe, a pardon. The fact is, the FDIC must follow the law. The statutory payout priorities are clear. Additionally, the FDIC tries to show that the amount at issue is really just $1 million. It's our position that once the FDIC waived its claim to that $30 million, then it descends to the next tier, who is us, the uninsured or underinsured depositors, and that $30 million, though that will be decided, I presume, in the district court if we get reversed and sent back down. It's our position that $30 million, once the FDIC said it doesn't have an interest in it, cascades down to the next priority, which is us, which would pay the underinsured depositors fully. The direct versus derivative action issue, what we are claiming is not that we were just harmed as account holders. This is similar to the securities law issue of holders versus purchasers, but it's a little different in the sense that we are asserting that the Ernst & Young financial records and the officers and directors, which was where the complaint started, lured people into the bank during this time by misrepresentations of their ability to structure their accounts so that people would obtain more than $100,000 in insurance coverage, and by misrepresentations as to the bank's financial condition. So we do make that distinction between people whose money was in the bank already and people whose money was lured into the bank during this period by these practices. That is the difference between a direct and a derivative claim, and those are the claims that we make in the as far as the RICO counts, those are the claims we make. It is not a derivative claim.
But you do have a lot of other issues with your RICO theories, such as what's the enterprise and what are the predicate acts and basic RICO kinds of problems.
Well, I don't know that we have problems with that. The Judge Gottschall went off on the idea that this was a derivative rather than a direct claim. But the fact is, this is... You start off with the FDIC.
Well, the nature of your injuries is the same. I mean, you didn't get paid the full amount of the accounts, I'll put it that way. And that's the same thing that happened to other people, whether their money was already in the bank at, let's say, $150,000 level, or whether the money was lured into the bank when the bank failed, the underinsured depositors came up short.
The measure of their damages is probably the same. But the actionable nature is different, that these were people during this time. We're talking about a time when most Americans were in the stock market. The only people who put their money in savings banks during this time were people looking for lifetime, protect their lifetime savings. This had to be the most secure. And so by luring people in with the notion that we have both the soundness of the bank, backed by the Pritzkers, with the financials of Ernst & Young and the solvency, and that we can structure your deposits during this time in a way that will get you more than $100,000 in insurance.
That part has bothered me about your theory, actually, both because of the widespread nature of information on what accounts are insurable, and also this, you know, this notion in a sense that we're going to enable you to cheat, if you will, on the $100,000 limit. Because of course, if I had three or four different accounts in a bank, it's still $100,000.
Judge Wood, with all due respect, when we talk about cheating, when people come in with their life savings to a bank, and the banker assigns them, tells them, we can structure this. This is a very complicated matter, but we can structure this so you'll get more than $100,000 in insurance coverage, make sure all your accounts are covered regardless of amount. That is something that the bank is in a much better position. That's something where they've cheated the individuals. We'll have to prove that, but we have testimony from our plaintiffs already that will support those allegations. And who should bear that risk between the individuals who made those misrepresentations and the individuals? It's not fair to do, as the FDIC would say this is a misrepresentation of law.
You're in your rebuttal time, you know.
Oh, if I could reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, I'd appreciate that.
Fine. Thank you, Mr. Criswell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Tanner?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Jacqueline Tanner. I represent the FDIC. With me are Michelle Odorizzi of Mayor Brown, who represents Ernst & Young, and Mr. David Haller of Covington & Burling, who represents the bank-related defendants. Ms. Odorizzi will address RICO issues, and Mr. Haller will present argument on the cross-appeal. There are several grounds for affirming the dismissal of appellant's claim to undo this very beneficial 2001 settlement. As our brief explains, there are at least three jurisdictional problems that he has not overcome, the counsel has not overcome. The one that the district court relied on properly, 1821J, courts have construed as a sweeping bar to equitable remedies against the FDIC, so long as it's operating in its function to resolve failed institutions, collect on the assets, and
so is it your position that if, and I'm not saying this is this case, I'm just trying to figure out the limits of your argument. If the FDIC collected $1 million for a failed bank, and they announced, we're tired of these statutory priorities, we're going to pay the shareholders first, and we're going to put the account holders at the end of the line until the shareholders are happy, that there would be no way a court could enjoin that?
No, Your Honor. Actually, an injunction probably would not be the route that the to complain of an action like that. The statute provides for money damages. There's a claims procedure, and that's the route that Congress determined would be followed. Rather than disrupt the, of course, it's a very extreme example.
No, I'm just trying to, as I said, I'm not saying that's this case at all.
I think our position is, so long as the FDIC is acting within its, was exercising its authority to resolve an institution, to dispose of the assets, and to collect, to maximize on the collections, that injunctive relief is not available.
Because the case law speaks in terms of, you know, kind of arguably, or, you know, if it can be construed in any way as acting legitimately. I get from it this idea, you know, giving them the benefit of the doubt, you know, could this be seen at all as legitimate administration of the estate? But there are limits, and when an agency is acting completely ultra vires, these statutes sort of kick in. I mean, they cover only the legitimate activities of the agency. When it acts completely beyond the scope of its authority, usually there's an exception to these statutes.
Well, my response would be, here the actions of the FDIC were completely legitimate, completely within its authority to settle claims that it acquired from a failed bank. The next point I'd make is that 1821J doesn't completely immunize the FDIC from claims. It It provides that the claim available would be a money damages claim and provides a process for seeking money damages. Here, that avenue is unavailable because a claim was never filed with the receiver for money damages. The other point, which is a broader point I'd like to make, is in response to something opposing counsel mentioned. When the $30 million is if the $30 million had been distributed, had been realized, which we argue here never happened, his clients and the FDIC are in exactly the same priority class. The statute speaks to depositors, so that the bulk of the deposits at Superior were insured deposits. The FDIC is subrogated to the rights of the insured depositors, and anything that gets distributed to depositors is distributed on a pro rata basis between the FDIC on behalf of the insured depositors and the uninsured depositors.
That's what we called FDIC receiver in our earlier opinion?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes, and the money would go back into the deposit insurance fund here, the safe, to replenish the fund and make up for the hole that was caused by the failure of the bank. So that we are exactly in the same position. The FDIC is exactly in the same position. The FDIC has the responsibility, the statutory obligation to maximize the net present recoveries and to minimize losses, to act in the best interest of the receiver. It's exactly what happened here. In 2001, the parties understood that the understanding was that each party separately had a claim against E&Y.
That's what I wanted to get to. Do we have to find that that the owners, the Dorman, Pritzkers, et cetera, had a legitimate claim against E&Y before we can go down the path that you'd like us to take and say this 25-75 split was part of the FDIC's powers to settle, and they could say we're only going to realize 75% of any settlement?
No, you don't, Your Honor. In 2001, no suit had been filed against E&Y by either party. The understanding was that both parties had claims against E&Y. There was a potential recovery. Of course, it could have been nothing, could have been anything at that point. And in order to maximize the money that the FDIC was to receive from the Pritzker-Dorman Group, which, by the way, was achieved without the expense, delay, uncertainty of litigation. It was money in the hands of the receiver. It was the largest single settlement with respect to a single institution. In order to take account of the fact that the both parties had these claims, they negotiated this term under which one of the parties would bring a single suit. The FDIC would control in this case, and the proceeds would be split. And in return, the owners would forego a separate claim or a separate suit against EY.
I assume you made the effort at that point. I mean, that's the whole purpose of this exercise: determine which you were more likely, which course would be more likely to bring you the largest amount of money.
Exactly, Your Honor. We felt that a single suit with the FDIC and the OTS as lead parties would be the most likely to get the most from on the EY claims. That certainly was a reasonable way of looking at an uncertainty at the time. It could have meant nothing for the owners. They would have gotten 25% of nothing. It was a term negotiated, as Your Honor has observed, to maximize the amount that would come back to the receiver that could be realized and distributed under the scheme. Again, as the court has recognized, the money that came in from the EY settlement, of that money, 75% by contract belonged to the receiver and was available for distribution, but the 25% was never an amount realized. Of course, there's no magic to the fact that money comes into the
No. You held it for a while, though.
Did hold it, yeah. Your Honor, but I think that isn't really the relevant point. The relevant point is it never belonged to the receiver. The receiver acted as a conduit The money came from E&Y, didn't come out of the receivership assets. It was in the nature of, to say that any money that the receiver holds for any period of time automatically becomes subject to the distribution scheme, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, what about a case of where the failed bank was the lead participant in a loan participation, and it was obliged to distribute loan proceeds, but the money would initially come to the receiver?
Aren't many cases like that. I mean, does the FDIC often enter into settlement agreements structured like this one?
The FDIC will structure agreements with a lot, as we've noted in our brief, sometimes putbacks, indemnities. They try to value litigation, put place a value on litigation, all in the interest of maximizing and fulfilling their statutory duty to maximize the net recoveries, because those recoveries will go to replenish the bank insurance fund as well as to satisfy claims of uninsured depositors. And unless the court has further questions, I'll defer to Mike.
Thank you, Ms. Tanner. Ms. Odorizzi?
Good morning. May it please the court. Michelle Odorizzi for the Ernst & Young. I'm just going to talk very briefly about the RICO claim. The gist of that claim really is, my opponent stated, that the Pritzkers and the Dwormans looted the bank. They say that E&Y made that possible because it signed off on bad financial statements, which were then given to the federal regulators. Now, plaintiffs admit that this ordinarily would be a claim that belongs to the FDIC as receiver, but they say that they're different because they put new money into the bank and that misrepresentations were made to them. Now, there are two problems with that argument. The first is that despite four tries at amending the complaint, plaintiffs still did not manage to allege a misrepresentation claim against any of the defendants. There's no allegation that they relied on anything that any of the defendants actually said.
So you're essentially taking a 9B kind of approach to this. You want to know who said, if you put your money in this bank, you will have $200,000 worth of insured deposits, not $100,000 or
something like
that?
Well, the insured deposits, I have to say, is Mr. Haller's client's issue. But, yes, there is no allegation that any of the actual defendants here said that. And from Ernst & Young's perspective, what you have is they've got several named plaintiffs. There's only one of them who claims that he was ever told anything about the safety or soundness of the bank. And what he alleges is that some bank officer showed him charts that are believed to have been based on Superior's audited financial statements. They never saw an audit opinion, and they never saw even an audited financial statement. So there is no basis for a direct claim under RICO against Ernst & Young. Their only claim is you had a hand in causing this bank to fail, and that hurt us. And it's quite clear.
How, if at all, was the public aware that Ernst & Young did the accounting work for Superior?
There is some information available on websites, but it's not the same as a publicly traded company that has SEC filings.
So when you say some information, if somebody was thinking of putting money in Superior, they could have done some kind of search and said, aha, Ernst & Young is the accountant?
They might have been able to, Your Honor, yes. But there's no allegation that anybody involved here did. But even if they did, even if there was a misrepresentation, the cases are quite clear that when your loss is as a result of the failure of the bank, that is a claim that belongs to the FDIC as receiver and can't be brought individually by depositors. The Popkin case, the Hamid case, which we cite, both say that. And in his reply brief, counsel cited the Hayes case in the Third Circuit. That's a case that allowed investors in stock in a bank to sue under Section 10B, but that case even distinguishes depositors and says if a depositor sues because of the failure of the bank, that still belongs to the receiver. So we would ask the court to affirm that portion of the decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Haller?
May it please the court, as you mentioned, David Haller. I represent the remaining defendants. And as Ms. Tanner previewed, I was going to address our cross-appeal, by which we request the court to reach the state law claims with respect to which the district court declined supplemental jurisdiction.
Mr. Haller, can you think of, or how many cases can you think of in which courts of appeals have found an abuse of discretion in dismissal of claims brought under the supplemental jurisdiction at this early stage of litigation?
Well, Your Honor, we cite a few cases. The Statland case, the Brzezinski case, and both of those were cases where the Seventh Circuit reached issues that the district court declined to reach and had dismissed the case. I don't think in any of those the court used the words abuse of discretion, perhaps being gentle to the district court, but did reach out and decide those claims and decided that the entire case should have been dismissed. In addition to those two cases, the Coe case, which we also cite, was a case where Judge Posner said, we should reach these claims based on supplemental jurisdiction. We should dismiss these state law claims, but we're not going to because there was no cross appeal, and the plaintiff didn't know that we were going to do that, and so we're going to send it back to the district court to exercise its discretion and address those claims. So Your Honor said, how many times have courts of appeals? I'm focusing
on
the Seventh Circuit.
It's very rare, I think it's fair to say. And I wanted to mention, too, that I thought there was something inherently contradictory in your argument, because you are, on the one hand, arguing that this is so straightforward and so perfectly presented right now that we ought to say not only that there was an abuse of discretion, but we ought to just wrap it up. And then, on the other hand, on places like page 49 of your brief, you say judicial efficiency, convenience, comedy, etc., all would be helped by, quote, a decision that spares the parties from resubmitting the preemption defense to the state courts and spares the state courts from wrestling with a significant question of federal law. And then there are other things that you say where you're saying, oh, we're going to save all this time for the state courts, and so this is a very complicated thing that they'll have to deal with. I don't have such a low opinion of the state courts. If it's really that straightforward, they can do it too.
Well, certainly I don't either, Your Honor. But the distinction is that I do think it would be a new and complicated issue for the state courts.
Why?
But it's
why no newer than or more complicated than for us?
Well, because the district court decided everything that was necessary to also dismiss the state law
claims. And the state courts will read that. I mean, it's not like we're sealing it up and hiding it from them.
That's perfectly true, Your Honor. I think when the district court determined to dismiss the RICO claim because those claims were owned by the FDIC and not the depositors, we cited numerous cases, including the recent submission of the Massey case, which said, look, all claims that seek to recover for injuries that were caused by the failure of a bank or by the bankruptcy of a company, however denominated, those are claims pursuant to federal law, pursuant to Section 1821 D2 of FERREA, that belong to the FDIC as receiver and not to the depositors. It doesn't matter how you denominate them. It doesn't matter what title the claim has. What matters is that you're seeking recovery because of that the injury was caused by the insolvency of the bank.
Right, and I understand that, but it seems to me if you were before the state court now, assuming we were to reject this, the first thing you would be saying is these individuals are really trying to assert claims that are not theirs anymore, they're claims that belong to the FDIC. And if the state court agreed with you, they would say to the plaintiffs, your Illinois Consumer Protection Act claims or whatever else they may have, are gone. You're not entitled to pursue these anymore, and the state court would dismiss, and that would be the end of it.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, I think, you know, there were significant briefing before the district court on five successive complaints. This court has wrestled with these issues and I think is clearly in a position and understands them in a way that it would not be difficult for the court to address them. And even if this court were to decide, no, there was not standing to assert the RICO claim, but there is standing for some reason to assert claims under the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act, it would be better for a single court to draw that distinction so that there was a reasoned difference why one claim was treated one way, another claim was treated another, rather than having the possibility that two different courts might decide that they're standing for one claim, not standing for the other, just because it's two different courts deciding it and seeing the issue differently. So I think there's a benefit
to uniformity. Now, that would frequently be the case, though, don't you think? I mean, why was 1367 written the way it was? It seems to me your argument would suggest that the presumption should have been the opposite for any case brought within the supplemental jurisdiction.
I think the difference here is, and this is one that, for example, the Coe case referred to the fact that in that case, the state law issues were very entangled with the federal law issues. Similarly, in the other case I mentioned, the Brzezinski case said, look, these are relatively straightforward state law issues. We've done a lot of work on the federal law issues. We can reach those relatively easily, and we should do so. If the state law claims are not so entangled, it would present a completely different situation.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Krizloff, how much time? 4 minutes, Mr. Krizloff.
Thank you, Judge Cannon.
Unfortunately, I don't have the facts of Coe at hand, but I believe Coe was one where it's different, but I can only suggest the court read the case to show how it's different. The allegations that we had four tries at the complaint, the four complaints were not to cure a failure. They were to add new things as, we would say, the news got better against the defendants. The first complaint was brought against the directors and officers basically for the misrepresentations. The second one added the Ernst & Young allegations of serial bookkeeping of bank records, of bank financial statements, and that it was done pertinent to the RICO claim. It was done not just to aid and abet the Pritzker-Dwarman group, but also to conceal the bookkeeping from becoming public because, as the FDIC alleged, had the $280 million errors in the bank's finances become public, it would have killed the deal that Ernst & Young had to sell their consulting arm to Capgemini for $11 billion. Don't trust my allegation. That's what the FDIC asserted against Ernst & Young. I'm interested in their Ms. Tanner's statement that the money would go as it cascades downward, that the deposits that they would be as FDIC receiver, I guess, for those insured deposits, they would get to participate on a pro rata basis.
Yeah.
So that if it's only a $1 million case on behalf of the uninsured depositors, it's still a $1 million case that money should have gone to those depositors. Although one could assert that the FDIC, I mean, this is a battle for another day, but one could assert that the FDIC waived any claim to this money on that priority basis. The fact is, even in their agreement, this was a claim against Ernst & Young. The Pritzker-Dwarman Group had made no claim, neither, I believe, not in arbitration, but certainly not in court. It is the largest single settlement, but that's not surprising. This is the largest bank loss suffered by the taxpayers at the hands of solvent defendants. And so he had the second biggest bank loss since the Depression, and the people who were responsible were among the deepest pockets, and I believe were listed in the Forbes 400 the other day as still among the wealthiest people in the country. It's no question that you're going to get a large settlement. The fact is, the assertion that the money came in never belonged to the receiver, it was always a recovery with respect to the FDIC's claim. Ms. Tanner, Mayhem, and Haw, this settlement is the only one of its kind. It is the only one of its kind in the history of the Republic. None others gave money back to the potential wrongdoers when depositors remained unpaid. With respect to the The 9B allegation, I think we've satisfied that with respect to depositors, but I don't think that depositors are required to satisfy the same things that a... We have 1 minute left. That are should be subjected to the same hurdles that securities... May I finish the sentence? Should be subjected to the same hurdles that securities fraud allegations are, because bank depositors are in a different category. They're not speculative investors. This is not a case where the Congress has legislated to try and shut down a bunch of these cases. This is a case where Congress has not seen fit to legislate to limit these claims in any respect. With all due respect, we ask that the court reverse the decision below and permit us to proceed ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Kislov. Thanks to both counsel, all counsel, I should say. The case will be taken under advisement.